Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. People gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Wednesday edition. Today's date is the 19th day of July, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and it's wonderful to have you here with me on this another sultry day in France. I know that America is also cooking over there. The whole world's heating up.
I was really born in France. My family's from France, and I'm warm-blooded anyway. It doesn't bother me.
Well, I'll tell you something, Eustace. I'm doing this. We've got Eustace Mullins, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I'll just let you know that right up front here. I'm sitting up in a loft in my farmhouse, and it's about 105 degrees where I'm sitting.
Oh, gosh, it's 105 all over the United States today.
Well, it's cooking, and you know, that doesn't matter because we've got important issues to discuss here. And see, one of the things that we've been doing is the current history and how the history of this information got its way to us. In other words, we've been looking at Zionism and its roots, and we've talked about the Khazarians, we've talked about all of the different Frankist movements and Sabbatai Z and all the different parts of this conspiracy. One of the things that's important, I think, is to bring people into the fact that people like Ben Friedman, like yourself, like Ezra Pound, like Myron Fagan.
Myron Fagan was a great guy. He was the first guy that publicized my work.
Well, see, all of these people were really the forerunners, and I don't take credit for the information that comes out. Basically, you guys were there to set the foundation for us to fight this war that we have with Zionism today. And so I'd like to start out with you by asking a couple of questions about, well, first of all, you met Ben Friedman, and you knew Benjamin Friedman, did you not?
I knew everybody. They're all dead now. It feels kind of funny to be the only survivor.
What was Benjamin Friedman like?
He was a heck of a guy. He was a scholar and a gentleman. And I was staying with Conrad Grebe. He's another one of the great pioneers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived about two blocks from Ben Friedman's house on Central Park West. And so I would go up there every morning and have breakfast with Ben and his son.
Well, I understood that he actually put a lot of his own money into this fight, did he not?
He really did. Well, you see, he was a kind of a benefactor of the New Deal because he was a supporter of Roosevelt. And Roosevelt let him have the Woodbury Soap Company.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his. He was making millions of dollars out of that soap company.
Well,
he
now...
He put it all in this fight. He wasn't saving any money.
Well, I understand that he spent $7 million of his own dollars trying to get this information into the hands of the public.
Well, I don't understand why they never killed him, because, you know, they used to beat up his son at school every day.
Really?
His son was going to a Jewish school, and they used to beat him up because of what his father was doing. And
wow.
And the poor kid looked scared to death all the time.
Oh, boy. Well, whatever did happen to his son, do you know?
I really don't know. I have no idea. His son now would be about 70 years old, and I had never heard a word about him.
Well, his father's a hero in my eyes, in the eyes of many, for the fact that, well, you know, he did participate in some of the terrible events of the last century, and in fact was one of the supporters early on. Do you know what transformed him, what one of the transforming factors was for him, why he changed?
I never talked personally with Ben about that. But he was totally dedicated. There's no question about it. But the first job I ever had, it wasn't a job, Ben was entirely financing the newspaper Common Sense in Union, New Jersey, and I was writing all the articles for it.
All right.
And that was the nation's anti-communist newspaper. It was the headline.
Now, he, Benjamin Friedman, was he also a good friend of Myron Fagan's?
Myron was in Hollywood. And I don't think Ben met him until later, years later. I didn't meet Myron until for about 25 years because Myron finally gave up his place in Hollywood and moved back to New York. I knew him in his last days in New York, and he was under constant attack even in New York.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. How do these people attack Eustace? What kind of things are typical of this Zionist cabal's attack on people who fight against them? What kind of things are they famous for doing?
Financial resources. That's the first line of attack. And if they have a job, they are a business. They destroy the job and business right away. In other words, they want you out on the street.
Ah. And I also understand from your association with Ezra Pound that they actually were getting doctors to declare Ezra insane, in fact, and basically they took away his freedom because of his speaking out against them.
Well, he was declared incompetent.
Yeah.
Because he insisted, they asked him how he would defend himself against this charge of treason, which is a capital charge. And Ezra said, I'll stand by everything I ever said over Radio Rome. And they were terrified at that because they didn't want him to do that. And so they called in three government psychiatrists. These were government employees and declared him incompetent to testify in his own defense because he insisted he was going to tell the truth.
Ah, and that's a little different way than the Germans are doing over in against Ernst Zundel. When Ernst was over there, they wouldn't even allow him to defend himself.
Oh, yeah, Zundel's an old friend of mine, too. I used to lecture with him in Canada. And what they're doing with Zundel shouldn't happen to anybody.
No. Well, is this typical of their methods, their modus operandi? They discredit, they destroy. What other things are they willing to do to us?
Well, they'll finally kill you if they have to. They haven't done that yet. You know, I had a very good job on the staff of the Library of Congress, where I did all my research from government documents. And that's why no fact has ever been challenged in my book in over 50 years. So the first thing they did, Senator Herbert Lehman, the billionaire banker, was the chairman of the National Anti-Defamation League.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had me fired from the Library of Congress. I'm the only person ever fired from the staff of the Library of Congress because of political activity.
Well, now, here's the interesting thing now. We know that you were able to get a lot of information for your book on the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
What kind of things are happening right now with the Federal Reserve that indicates that we are... Do you think we're heading for a financial calamity soon?
Well, there's no reason to have a calamity because that's like a herdsman will kill his cow that's giving the milk. See, as long as we're giving milk, we're safe.
Well, it looks like the finances of the country are getting strained by recent events, and in fact, it looks like the economy itself is in tatters at the moment.
Well, 2/3 of our national debt is owned by China and Japan.
Yep.
They're keeping us alive in order to keep trading with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's purely a matter of market operations. It has nothing to do with ideology whatsoever.
Well, how about the people who control the Federal Reserve? What information can you share with our listeners about the controllers of the Federal Reserve?
Oh, I have all that information in my book. It was published in 1953, and it has never changed.
Now, and what families are involved in that?
John D. Rockefeller is the principal organizer of it, and he put all of his Federal Reserve stock into tax-exempt organizations that can never be bought or sold.
So, but I mean, we've got people like the Schiff family. We've got people like the Loeb
and John D. Rockefeller. They were three families that were the main organizers of the Federal Reserve System. It's just like if you went into partnership with anybody to start some business. That's all. It was a standard business operation.
Now, do the Rothschilds hold the strings to the Federal Reserve?
They do indeed. In fact, Baron Alfred Rothschild of London commissioned the original Jekyll Island meeting at which they drafted the Federal Reserve Act in secret.
And he did it through his agent Schiff, did he not?
Pardon?
He did it through his agent Schiff.
Yeah.
His name was Schiff, right?
Yeah, see, Jacob Schiff grew up in the Rothschild house in Frankfurt, Germany. He was actually a member of the family. He wasn't a direct member of the family, but they took him in, and he was raised there in the Rothschild house. And so they sent Jacob Schiff to New York to organize the firm of banking house of Kuhn Loeb Company.
Mm-hmm.
And Kuhn Loeb Company was the secret branch of the Rothschilds. It was never identified as a Rothschild operation, but everybody knew that it was Rothschild because Schiff was running it. The Rothschilds always claimed that they were not operating in the United States at all, and they were running the whole country.
Well, what relationship do the Rothschilds have to the Rockefellers?
There was no direct relationship. You see, Kuhn Loeb Company financed the entire John D. Rockefeller oil operation. John D. Rockefeller was a $10 bank clerk in Cleveland, Ohio. And the National City Bank in Cleveland financed his tremendous growth.
And it was coming from the Rothschild fortunes.
It's the Rothschild fortunes. The Rothschilds also financed the Harriman family, and they built the Union Pacific Railroad. So the Harrimans became enormously wealthy, and they became so wealthy that they hired the Bush family to handle their financial operations.
Now, when Bush was dealing directly with the Nazis, was that a clandestine way for the Rothschilds to support the Hitler regime?
Oh, well, the Hitler regime was actually financed entirely by Felix Warburg and by Felix Oppenheimer. And those two firms are operating in Hamburg, Germany today, the two big bankers in Germany. And they entirely financed the Hitler operation.
Now, what kind of influence was he exacting on the regime to do his bidding? What kind of bidding was he demanding from Hitler?
Well, he wasn't demanding much of anything, really, because, you see, they were like P.T. Barnum with the circus. The whole thing was a circus operation. And as long as they kept the circus going, everything was fine.
But did they not demand certain policies to be implemented?
Oh, yes, they certainly did. But that was at the top level. There's no records of that whatsoever.
And is it, from what you understand, were they working together to get an exodus of the Jews from Northern Europe?
They were trying to transfer the Jews to Israel for Palestine.
Yes. That's right.
That was the whole purpose of the Hitler regime, the so-called Nazis. They were setting up an immigration policy for German Jews to migrate to Palestine and build the state of Israel over there.
And so, what did they say? What did Rothschild want him to create an environment that was so inhospitable to Jews that they would migrate on their own?
Oh yes, you know, Alfred Eichmann is always touted as the greatest anti-Jewish person of Hitler regime, and Adolf Eichmann was actually Hitler's personal contact with the Jewish colonists in Palestine.
Hmm. Now, how about Rudolf Hess and his Spandau prison time? Why was this man held in prison with hundreds of guards guarding him by himself in Spandau? What was it that he knew that they didn't want the rest of the world to know?
Well, Rudolf Hess knew it firsthand, and that's why he flew to England to make peace with England. Rudolf Hess knew that the whole thing was a circus, a charade. Because, you see, German Jewish bankers like J. Henry Schroeder and Company had built huge banking houses in England, and they were the most important bankers in England after the Rothschild. And so during the 1930s, they formed the German-American Friendship Association in England, which was very pro-German. And they ran this pro-German propaganda operation all during the 30s, and that was a so-called peace offensive, which they were trying to get England to surrender to Hitler.
Hmm. Now why in the world would the Jews, who had been treated so well in Germany, turn so viciously on the Germans? Is it the only reason was to get the Exodus, or did they also want to punish the Goyim?
No, well, it was partly the punishing of the Goyim, which is standard procedure with them. They do that whether they win or lose. They always punish them. And they always attack their victims. Mm. Just like they're attacking the American people now. The American people are the principal victims of the Zionists right now. Our country has been bankrupted. Our soldiers are being killed. And this is all to help the state of Israel. You know, all the news commentators have been screaming for Bush to send ground armies against Iran and Syria because of this current charade in the Middle East.
And basically that is to weaken and destroy the Goyim of America.
Oh, yes. They intend that the Goyim will be entirely weakened and on the stage of collapse when they get rid of us, when they're through with us.
Do they intend to have a genocidal period after we're collapsed in the United States? Would that be like what they did in the Bolshevik Revolution when they took power? They actually killed 30, 40 million people after they took their power.
Well, they killed a million of people a year between 1917 and 1989. That's 72 years. That's 72 million people. And they killed a million people the first year of the Bolshevik Revolution, and they killed a million of people for 80 years after that. That's a lot of people.
Now, they did that, why? Because they wanted to punish the Goyim, or they wanted, what kind of benefit were they getting out of this mass murder?
Well, it was an extermination program. Just like they're trying to exterminate all the Arabs in the Middle East right now. That is the attack on Lebanon right now. They want to kill every Arab in the Middle East. And I said that for years, and no one else ever says that.
Well, Christopher John Berkus does say that, and he said it last night on this program. And he's a researcher who actually is mirroring exactly the things you're saying, Eustace.
Oh, yes. Well, any realistic observer of the situation in the Middle East would say exactly what I'm saying. There's no other conclusion that you can draw.
Do you know that the Iranians may be clandestinely working with these Zionists in order to implode the Iranian nation?
Oh, Mossad put the present Iranian regime into power. They're the ones that overthrew the Shah and brought the mullahs in to run the country. That was one of Mossad's best operations, and they've run a country ever since.
Didn't they bring the Ayatollah Khomeini from Paris back to Iran?
Oh yes, they had maintained the Ayatollah for 20 years in Paris. They paid all his expenses, and they flew him in a CIA plane back to Iran to take over the country when they fomented the revolution against the Shah.
Now, why did they want the Shah out? Didn't they have control of the Shah of Iran?
Well, they had control because all of his oil was sold. And all the money was banked in Switzerland, but they just wanted to get rid of him as a power figure. They wanted the reigning family of Iran.
The Pahlavi family, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They wanted to eliminate that family and bring in some hardliners or something?
Well, the mullahs were perfect operators for them because they could control the mullahs, you see. And the mullahs have faithfully followed all of their policies since they installed them as the supposed leaders of Iran, the Shah's successor.
So are they going to hand the Iranian public over to these to this slaughter?
Well, they're trying to do it right now. They want ground armies. George Bush is straining at the leash to obey Israel and unleash ground armies against both Iran and Syria and wipe them out for good. But you see, we don't even have any soldiers to do that. All of our soldiers are committed. Bush is in a terrible position because he does not have the capability of following Zionist orders now.
Well, it seems to me, Eustace, we are following some kind of bizarre messianic.
It's messianic. It's fanatical. It's the Masada complex of the Zionist people. If
now,
they don't get what they want, they'll commit suicide.
Well, now who are the leaders of this? Is this coming out of the Chabad Lubavitch? Are these the Lubavitchers doing this?
Yeah, the Lubavitchers. They are the real power behind the throne, and people in the United States have no idea of that whatsoever.
Well, they're actually a growing force within Hasidim right now, and they're trying to spread themselves throughout America.
Oh, yes,
and in fact, they've been building centers across the United States as power centers. There's a big one in Los Angeles. There's one in Miami. There's one in Chicago. They've got a huge one in Brooklyn, of course. And it comes on the heels of this Menachem Schneerson and his ascension to the title of Messiah. Was he anointed the Messiah?
I really don't know. That's an internal operation, I suppose he was. But you see, the Lubavitchers have been very big in New York for many years. Although, when I lived in New York, I never heard of the Lubavitchers.
Well, does a New Torah Carta fight with them because they don't agree that, I mean, does New Torah Carta think that we're Goyim are less than cattle as well?
Oh, yes, they do. They have the true Zionist outlook on things. But New Torah Carta sounds absolutely true blue to me. They're right on our target all the time.
So basically, they just having an internal disagreement, but they're not out to help the Goyim.
Oh, no, they're not helping. I think it's a typical operation of controlled opposition. That they always like to have an opposition, but they want an opposition that they entirely control.
Mm.
You see, when we went to war against Hitler in 1941, of course, nobody in this country had any idea that the Zionists controlled Nazism 100%.
The war effort from America was controlled by Zionists, and the war that we were fighting against, the people we were fighting against, were also controlled by them.
That's exactly right. That's been true of every war in this century. You know, they say the 20th century was the century of world war, but they were world wars in which both sides were entirely controlled by the Zionists. And, of course, they did whatever they were told to do.
And in fact, the attack on Russia was all fomented and formulated behind the scenes and in the Zionist boardrooms.
Oh, yes, that was purely Zionist. You see, they put Woodrow Wilson elected President Woodrow Wilson in 1912 to sign the Federal Reserve Act into law and to start World War One. The purpose of the Federal Reserve Act was to start World War One. Because the European countries are bankrupt and they couldn't afford a world war. So Congress voted Woodrow Wilson $100 million, which was a lot of money at that time, in 1917 as his emergency war fund. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson turned right around and sent that emergency war fund to the Bolsheviks in Moscow because they were collapsing. They had no money whatsoever.
So basically, America financed the Bolshevik Revolution, is what you're saying?
Well, they financed the Bolshevik Revolution and all Soviet activities from 1917 to 1989. And communism supposedly collapsed in 1989, a financial collapse. What the American government in Washington decided was to stop supporting communism. And they immediately collapsed. That was the fall of communism, which Ronald Reagan boasts that he caused the collapse of communism, which is total nonsense. He supported them all. He was known as Red Ronnie in Hollywood, and he was known always as a communist supporter.
Is there a single politician that comes to your mind that's not bought and paid for by these people?
Well, they have to be bought and paid for before you hire them. You can't have people that you don't own who may turn against you. They're all completely controlled.
How about in the world at large? Are there any leaders of Muslim countries or Islamic nations that are not bought and paid for?
Oh, no. The Islamic nations are the easiest to control of all because they have a cohesive religion and they're very easily influenced.
Well, now, I've got a guy named Mahathir Mohamad out of Malaysia. For 27 years, he was the prime minister, and he ruled that country quite strictly, and he has come out recently virulently against Zionism and actually named names and been very very clear and succinct about what they're doing and who they are. Is this man also under their thumb, or is he somebody that's kind of a wild card?
Oh, he's not under their thumb at all. He's a complete rebel because he's one of our greatest fans. He's promoting our book all over Malaysia. And he's written a book, another book of his own, which is a spin-off of my book, praising my work and my fight against the Zionist bankers.
Well, he's actually he did a deal that saved his country from being sold out to the World Bank.
Oh, I know that.
The IMF World Bank, when the implosion of the Asian countries happened in 1993, he actually said, no, keep your loans, we don't want them. And in fact, he refloated his economy on his own and never went into debt to the IMF and World Bank.
Oh, yeah, he did a great job, and he's known all over the world for what he did. And, no, he'll stick to his guns. He's not going to work for these people.
So Malaysia is one of the countries in the world that maybe is not completely owned and operated.
Probably the only one. I can't think of any others.
Well, what do you think the plans of the Zionists will be to stop them from being the foil in this fight?
Well, they'll work on them from behind the scenes, and we probably won't know even know what they're doing. But they'll do everything they can to bring them into submission at some point.
Well, how do we defeat these people, Eustace? And what is it the French Connection can do other than just squawking on the radio all the time? What can we do to beat them? I mean, we're getting great numbers. We're getting over 10,000 people a day to the website. But that's not going to do it, Eustace. We need a cascading growth of this information to find its way all over the world. How is it that we can make this thing explode across the world?
Well, it will explode. A lot of the information is exploding on the Internet right today, and that's our greatest strength. They're informing more people than all the rest of the world put together.
Well, can I tell you something? When Eric Hufschmidt, my engineer, and I started back a year ago, I Googled Zionism into Google, into the search engine, and I got 17,000 hits, 17,000 representations of Zionism.
Oh, yes.
Today, if you Google Zionism, you get 750,000.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Well, it's swallowing up everything.
Well, it's actually what's happened is it's grown exponentially. And I don't take full credit for it because the work you've done is what's laid the groundwork for me and Benjamin Friedman and Myron Fagan and even this guy Rosenthal, this idiot that worked for Jacob Javits.
Oh, yeah, Ben Rosenthal.
What an idiot he was. Boy, he tipped the hand of the whole conspiracy, this guy.
He really did.
Well, but now all this stuff has actually been starting to be taken seriously in the public, in at least in the alternate press public. And what they're trying to do is fight tooth and nail to discredit myself and others. How do we fight back against the discrediting stuff that they're going to do?
Well, keep up with your work. Yeah, keep on doing your work. They've fought me for 60 years, and they've spread all kinds of stories that I was a commandant of a Jewish death camp all during the World War II, all sorts of things. They even spread the story that I was a Luftwaffe pilot for Hitler during World War II. They'll do anything to discredit you, but most people don't pay any attention to that because it's pure nonsense.
Well, you know, Eustace, whenever I've spoken to you, this is the third time we've been together on the radio, and I got to tell you, I'm proud to know you. And in fact, when I say it's Daryl Bradford Smith calling, you go, "How are you?" You know me. That warms my heart because there are very few people on earth that I have more respect for than you. And that's not trying to blow smoke up your skirt.
The fact of
the matter is, this is a terrible battle that we're in,
and I understand
the consequences of failure. So failure is not an option for us, is it?
Oh, no, it is not. Survival is our option.
That's right. So my goal is not to instill fear in my listening public, but rather have them understand the fact that we need to have a larger audience for this, because it is the numbers that will force their hand. It is the growth in our message that will force them to finally have to capitulate the truth. And once that happens, they're finished.
Well, that's absolutely true, and that, my experience is that, too. Well, when I first wrote my books in the 1950s, no publisher would touch anything ahead with a 10-foot pole, and I had to publish and circulate my own books. My books were never reviewed, and yet they sold steadily, and they've been selling for 60 years. And that's what you have to do. You have to fight your way through. It's like the pioneers landing in America. You're starting with virgin territory, and you just got to go in and clear the forests.
I like that analogy. Well, you know, here's the thing I'd like to get into today with this Lebanon thing. Of course, they have a goal of a wider Israel, and even on the Knesset wall, they've got a picture of Israel that's stretches from the Tigris and Euphrates all the way down to the Nile. And are they right now in the process of instituting that very plan that we all fear they're going to institute? Is this what's happening at the moment?
Well, they're trying to, but a commentator said last night that every time Israel has gone into Lebanon, it's been a disaster for Israel because it was too big a step and they weren't prepared to carry through with it. And they're not prepared now. And they're praying that George Bush will send armies against Syria and Iran. And George hasn't got any troops to do that.
So what is it they're doing? Are they just going to be spinning their tires here? Or are they going to fail at this? I mean,
well, they fail at a lot of things, you see. Everything they do is a tremendous gamble. But their survival depends on gambling and playing the odds. And so far they've muddled through only because of the American people. You see, it's American airplanes that are killing the Arabs in Lebanon today.
That's right. And
they haven't paid for one bullet that's killing Arabs in Lebanon. And with that American taxpayers' money, they wouldn't be able to kill a single Arab.
Well, here's the interesting thing, Eustace. They've got 8 and 9 year old Israeli young children signing these bombs to ship to shoot over into Beirut.
Oh yes.
So this is the most horrific thing I've ever seen. Israeli Jewish children are being taught that murdering people through bombing is the way to go. And this is the sickest thing I've ever seen in my life.
It is sick, but this is every child in Jerusalem is exactly.
And, what do they teach their children, Eustace, that we're less than humans?
Well, that everybody's less than human except them. As far as they're concerned, they're dealing with animals, so they have no moral qualms about anything.
How could that be that a Zionist could actually look at another human being, Eustace, and consider them to be less than human?
Well, they've got 5,000 years of tradition behind it. If you believe something for 5,000 years, you begin to believe it. And that's exactly the way they regard other people.
So these people are truly a cancer, aren't they?
Oh, they really are.
And the saddest part about it is there are many, 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 many good Jews out there in the world who are.
I've met Ben Friedman. In fact, when I went to New York, associated almost entirely with Jews because they were the only people I could talk to.
And they were wonderfully kind people as far as I've ever experienced.
Oh, very kind. Oh, yes, they were always good to me.
Well, see, this is the painful thing for me as a researcher and a person fighting for the freedom of my nation and the world. When I have to say horrible things about Zionists, but I have to qualify it that, look, not all of these people are involved, and many, many people out there are going to get swept up in the pogrom. And it's a difficult call here, but this is a very small percentage of the world population trying to kill us all.
Oh, that's
now,
exactly.
How the heck do we square the circle of trying to protect the innocent Jews from the Zionist Jews?
Well, it's like AIDS or cancer or anything else. You just got to protect yourself against it, against the infection.
Yeah. And it is an infection. It's a sickness. Now, they've also started using research in bio weaponry that is very frightening to me because people...
That's something they'll use at any opportunity.
Well, here's the thing that they've been experimenting with. Genetic diseases that only affect certain races of people.
Oh, yes.
And you and I both know they've got a huge investment in parts of Israel that do just a high-level bio research. And I got to tell you, I'm certain that it's not for peaceful purposes.
No, it's never for peaceful purposes. It's the ultimate weapon of war.
And are they willing to unleash this on the planet?
Oh, they are more than willing. They're preparing for it.
How would we as a group prepare for it ourselves?
Well, we have to know about it, and we have to be knowledgeable as to how they operate, and be ready for it.
Now, what kinds of experiences about the modus operandi of the Mossad could you share with us? Because the Mossad is a little known group. I mean, not a lot of people know how these people operate. And Eric and I have spoken often about their false flag operations and the way that they foment these murder sprees and blame it on opposition. And are there things that about the way they operate that can be shared? You know, how we can identify their operations?
Mossad, yes, because. Well, one of the principal methods of operation is that all Mossad agents all over the world operate with foreign passports. Most of Mossad agents have an American passport, which is probably turned over to them by our government.
Really? Who in our government is the...
is a perfect cover for a secret agent. He can go anywhere in the world on an American passport, and they accept him as bona fide. So they steal American passports, and they buy them through bribery, and they do anything they can to get their hands on an American passport.
And then they do these crimes around the world in the name of Americans.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Now, are there specific ways that they will surveil you? Have you been surveilled by the Mossad?
Oh, they surveil you by mail, telephone, by any means of communication whatsoever. I've had telephone trouble for the last 4 years.
Well, I've got telephone trouble, terrible trouble with my phone over here, Eustace, and I'm not sure if it's my French it's my French government or it's the Americans or who the hell it is. I don't know anymore.
It's all governments. You know, I used to mention the FBI and the CIA very freely over the telephone because they were listening.
Well, here's the next question. Jacques Chirac has come out and said that the invasion of Lebanon is abhorrent and sick, and that it should be ceased immediately.
Well, it's revolting because it would turn anybody against the Zionists.
Well, now, Jacques has had a lot of problems with Israel. They're actually calling him an anti-Semite right about now.
Oh,
and
they,
his
they
opposition...
That's what they start off with.
Do you think he's with them or against them?
Become an anti-Semite.
Is he with them, against them, or is this a false flag kind of thing? What's going on with that?
Well, it's just a standard operation. It's the way they operate all the time. They take you as an ally as long as they can, and when you stop doing their bidding, then they turn against you.
Hmm. Well, I know that the opposition presidential candidate is a full-fledged Zionist, and I've avoided speaking about him, and I will today as well because of the fears I have of being imprisoned over here. So, and you know, the French are actually the country that trained the original Mossad, are they not?
Oh yes, that's their training camp. But I was the last time I was in Canada, I was speaking with David Icke. We were touring up there. And the Canadian government threatened us both with deportation, and we had to go into hiding. I was in hiding in Toronto and Montreal. People were driving around all day. I don't go to a motel. And I haven't been back in Canada since. That's been 5 years ago.
Well, no, but now France is a little different because, you know, I'm wondering how much France has signed on to this Zionist idea.
Oh, you know, during the 19th century... France was the most anti-Zionist country in the world because it was a very strong Catholic country and a Christian country, and they always opposed Zionism, even in its earliest days. So that is why the French have always been suspect in the eyes of the Zionists.
Really?
And Bill O'Reilly, who is Fox's chief commentator on the Fox Network, he actually organized a personal boycott against France for the Zionists, and he still is carrying that on.
Well, here's the interesting thing, because the one half of the Rothschild fortune resides in France.
Oh, certainly. James Rothschild completely owned the Bank of France for many years. And so the French government, well, in 1820, the French government announced that James D. Rothschild in Paris had more money than the royal family, which was true. It was the richest family in France.
Well, they still are. I know that. And they own half the city of Bordeaux. I know that as well. Now, here's the interesting thing that I'm getting to here. Was the European Central Bank and the European Union a Zionist-run operation?
Oh, yes, indeed. See, the central banks were their main method of power through the 19th century. That's how they took over country to country. The Bank of France, the Deutsche Bank, the Bank of England, those were all Jewish operations. And that was their method of exercising control.
Mm. So now, where do you say we're at in this next stage here? You're watching world events. You're seeing Lebanon flare up. You're seeing the attempts to get Iran invaded. All these different things. How do we see this? How do you see this going forward in the short and medium term here?
Well, in the short and medium term, I think it's a 70-30 operation. I think that we're still 70% in charge of our own destination. But the 30% that's opposing us is very powerful, and they're working very hard to make it 100%.
Mm. So basically right now, it's not a done deal, and certainly we've got our ability to put some monkey wrenches in their gears there. So what do you suggest that the people fighting for the truth and the facts do at this moment? I mean, if you were the brain trust behind some decision making to stop them, what would your next move be for us to get these people halted in their tracks?
Well, I would redouble all efforts, because actually Israel is in a very ticklish position right now. They're overextended. They've gambled too heavily, and their plans are not going through. So this is it's a very weak a period of weakness for them. This is a good time to fight back.
It certainly is, and I can sense that as well, and so can many other people, especially in light of the explosion of this Zionist conspiracy. I mean, it's coming out, and they don't know how to stop it. And here's the interesting thing, Eustace: the more they attempt to stop it, the more people who are with them are being exposed.
Oh, they certainly are, and you know, they're in such bad shape right now that neither the Democratic or the Republican Party has a presidential candidate for the next election. I mean, these people are up the creek. They got Hillary Clinton, but they don't dare run Hillary because there's so much opposition there that she'll never get off of first base.
Well, they're talking about Giuliani, who's a complete Zionist.
Oh, yeah. Well, Giuliani is their whole card. They're finally going to ditch Hillary and run Giuliani.
Well, how about McCain too? McCain's family was given $100 million business through the Brofman fortune, wasn't he?
Oh yeah. Well, all over Arizona, the McCain family is known as the mafia operation. All our money comes from the mafia.
Now John McCain's father was the guy who hush-hushed the USS Liberty attack.
Oh, is that the one? I didn't know that. I can well believe it.
Well, Admiral Kidd was the man on the ground, but Admiral McCain is the guy who squashed any press of it in America.
Oh yes.
Well, so I guess his recompense for that was to receive $100 million no bid contract for distribution of alcohol and drinks in the Southwest.
Well, I think that McCain is probably their home card also for the next election, because they'll run McCain and Giuliani and try to win that way. I don't think it'll work, frankly.
Well, especially now that we're going to come out against both of those men in a very strong way, so that by the time the election cycle comes around, people won't even want to stand in the same room with these two guys.
Well, I don't think they would, because McCain to every Vietnam veteran is known as a collaborator with the communists of Vietnam.
That's right, he was.
Yes.
He's a coward and a treasonous dog is what he is.
Well, because...
Eustace, the painful thing is, and this is what I realized, was that the service that I thought I was rendering to my country turned out that I was giving my service over to a Zionist government, not the government of the United States.
Oh, yes, I served World War II, but at no time during World War II did I know I was fighting for a Zionist government.
Well, now that we do know that, the other group I'd like to start targeting for information is our military.
Well, I was distributing material for Gerald R. K. Smith through the Air Force all the time I was in service. It's no wonder I didn't get myself shot. Yeah, Gerald Smith was sending me boxes of stuff, and I was distributing it in the squadron day rooms all over the air base.
Well, you know, Eustace, this is a war. I try to keep a positive face on myself here and work as positively as I can. But then I see images of young girls signing bombs and things. And then all of a sudden, from trying to stay positive, I get sick to my stomach. I wonder how you could do this for so many years and just not have ulcers from being sick all the time.
Well, I'm not sick at all, people. When I answer the phone, people say, well, you sound 10 years younger than you. Or I don't understand it. And it's faith, really, because my faith tells me that these people cannot win.
Yeah.
And that's what gives me strength.
But you know what? Like I said, though, I mean, I see these young girls, and I wonder to myself, what kind of future are we building if we're telling young children the things that the Israelis are telling their young children, that it's okay to murder, that signing bombs is the way to go, this kind of sickness. And then I look at the youth of the United States, and I see them piercing their heads and their tongues and being, maiming themselves and doing sick things and being completely disassociated from quality endeavors and pursuits. And I'm wondering to myself, in every instance, there's a Zionist group behind the sickness. And I'm wondering how we're going to get these young people awoken to these facts, but at the same time, stop the poisoning of this generation.
Well, the young people have no heroes. That's the trouble. And I'm fighting to revive the memory of Senators Joe McCarthy and H.L. Hunt and Ezra Pound. I mean, real Americans who gave their lives for this country.
Yeah.
And they should be the models for our young people.
Yeah. Well, I agree. And sadly, the criminals have been writing our history.
Oh, all of it. In fact, you know, this all started during the 1930s when the so-called German refugees came flooding into this country, and they were Trotskyite communists. And because the Hitler regime was very anti-communist, the communists were all moving to the United States, and they went right into the universities, and they became chairman of the history department and chairman of the economics department, and they controlled history of this country since 1936.
Hmm. And then they went back in history and rewrote all that, too.
Oh, after World War II, they rewrote everything.
Well, none of this surprises me anymore, and there are no shocks for me anymore, although there
are no shocks whatsoever.
Are there some people fighting the good fight? Are you familiar with Norman Finkelstein?
Oh, I haven't met him, but he certainly has stuck his neck way out.
Yeah.
And Norman Finkelstein is like a lot of Jews are appalled by what their own people are doing. Ben Friedman is like that.
Yeah, but I agree. But there are some false ones out there, like Barry Shamish and some others that are really apologizing for the Jews and trying to set up different things that are really not truthful.
Oh, yeah, they set up dummy operations and fake organizations which are double oriented so they can represent both sides.
Eustace, battling these folks is not a pleasure, but it certainly is something I'm proud of. And I got to tell you, having known you as long as I have, which isn't very long, I see that you've taken pride in your efforts. So is there something you'd like to share with the listeners before we end this interview here?
Well, I would say that I've been very fortunate. Most people say I've had a very tough life, but I think I've been very fortunate to know people like Ben Friedman and Ezra Pound and true Americans who believe in the survival of this nation.
Yeah.
And that's what they're the people we have to believe in. And I'm following their precepts every day of my life because they showed me the way, and there's no other work that I would even think of doing, and it's all on this earth.
Well, you may be one of the greatest American heroes of all time, Eustace, because you've stood the test of time and you've battled back against the odds. And I got to tell you, I'm proud of you, and I'm proud to know you. And I got to say this, sir. We here at the French Connection, and Eric Hushmidt, myself, and others that work with us every day, our goal is to tell as many people as we can, and not to make them fearful, but to embolden them to continue the battle.
No, this is a Paul Revere operation. You're trying to warn people. You're not trying to scare people.
That's right. Now, some of this stuff is a little scary, and you got to admit.
It's scary.
Yeah, sure it is.
I was just starting out now. I don't know if I'd even get into it because I had no idea the odds against me.
Well, you know, I think I've lost my marbles here, but at the same time, you know, there's a certain amount of satisfaction in knowing that you're doing something good for humanity and good for your nation and good for your children. And these are the things I hang on to more than anything else.
Well, that is the real satisfaction that you can live with for the rest of your life. And you never have to regret a single thing you've ever done, and that's a pretty good thing.
It sure is. Well, you know, I know you're a believer in supreme beings, and I know that you believe that at some point this is going to turn around for us. And I'm hoping that my efforts and the efforts of so many thousands of people out there are going to make a difference soon.
Well, because, it will make a difference.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see the suffering of those poor people in Lebanon stopped. I mean, as we speak, we need to bring the attention of the world onto this because there is suffering going on as we speak, and these people have murdered hundreds of millions of people over the last couple of hundred years, and they're certainly not interested in stopping now. So,
well, they're not stopping at all. They're going to increase their genocide over there. You know that the Israelis have been very frank that their goal is to exterminate all the Arab population in the Middle East.
Well, we're not going to let them do that. I can tell you that.
No, we're not going to let them do it. And I wish that the Washington government would stop financing them and getting the weapons to kill people with.
Well, that's for us to battle back against, I think. But I want to thank you, Eustace, for spending this time with us. You know, every time you've been on has just been a treat for us, and I'm proud to know you, my friend. And I wish you a wonderful continuation of your day. And you know, stay cool over there because I tell you something.
I'm cool. I'll take care of myself.
Well, I've been sitting here in 105 degree heat. I'll let everybody know that. And
well, it's
this,
only about 95 here, and actually, it's not unpleasant at all. It's 80 and 90 degrees temperature doesn't bother me that much.
Well, up here in my loft, see, I'm up in the second floor here cooking. But it's been great to have you on, Eustace. You're a wonderful guest and a wonderful patriot, and I'm proud to know you. And we'll talk again soon, sir.
Well, good. I've been looking forward to this talk, and I'll do it again when we get the chance.
Thank you, my friend. Bye bye now.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wonderful statesman, a kind man, an honest man, and somebody who's never shrunk from the fight here. This is what somebody I model myself after, because in this battle that we have brewing here, this big battle that's coming, we've been fighting for a long time, but there is a big fight coming. And, you know, I may or may not be there with all of you there to fight it, but certainly I'm going to fight until my last breath against what these people are doing, because the consequences of not fighting, as Ezra Pound has said in the past, as Ben Friedman has said, and as Eustace Mullins just told you, is too horrific to even consider. So each and every one of us need to stop what we're doing and spend a lot of time becoming well-informed and start fighting this real fight, the real battle. Stop being mired in the lies and nonsense and deception of people like Alex Jones and others who refuse to address these problems. You know, Eustace Mullins does not get a full airing on people like Alex Jones and others because simply They're not interested in telling the truth. They're interested in continuing the problems that are there. They're protecting the crimes, not exposing them. So our job here is to expose the crimes and the criminals and to spread this word and give everyone a message of hope. And I hope that came across today, and I hope that you were all inspired by Eustace Mullins as much as I was, at least. And until the next show, ladies and gentlemen, it'll probably be tomorrow or Friday. We have Dr. Lorraine Day coming on and some others coming up. Lots of great interviews here on The French Connection. The battle is on, ladies and gentlemen. We are not a radio show. We are not, let me repeat, not a radio show. This is a political movement, and we are fighting for the future of our planet. Make no mistake about it. We're in the middle of the biggest battle in human history, and it's up to you to fight with us to win this battle for all of us. So until we come back, ladies and gentlemen, till the next broadcast, thank you very much, and be well. Bye-bye now.